This episode could be triggering for sensitive listeners and contains mature content. It may not be suitable to all listeners. Should you need any emotional assistance, please see the show notes for telephone numbers that you can call. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are my own and do not reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by contributors, such as the host, guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors, are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. When a grandfather and his grandson go for a leisurely bicycle ride in their local park, the grandfather spots two men who look like they are soliciting his grandson. This interaction will kick off a picketing campaign that will bring a small church with some very strict beliefs to the forefront. This is Decoding Cults, and I'm your host, Palsy. This episode is about the Westboro Baptist Church, Part 1. In this episode, we will delve into the early days of the leader and see how this group came to be. Fred Waldron Phelps was born on 13 November 1929 in Meridian, Mississippi. His father, Fred Wade Phelps, was a World War I veteran and had become a railroad policeman for the Columbus and Greenville Railway. A railroad policeman is responsible for the protection of railroad properties, facilities, equipment, personnel, passengers, and cargo. According to the Institute of Transportation, trains served as the most important mode of transportation during a period of time called the Golden Age of Railroads, which lasted from the 1880s until the 1920s. Fred's mother, Catherine Idelette, was a stay-at-home mom. Catherine loved to play the piano and would often open all of the windows in the house so that the neighbors could listen to her play. People who knew her at the time noted that she was a very kind person. The Phelpses welcomed a little girl called Martha Jean a few years later. On 29 October 1929, the Great Depression began in America with the Wall Street crash. The economic downturn was devastating, spreading across the world and lasting for just over a decade, finally ending in 1941. By all accounts, the Phelps family was doing well despite these circumstances, mainly because of Fred Sr.'s job with the railroad. The Phelpses were highly respected in their community. On 3 September 1935, 28-year-old Catherine sadly lost her life to throat cancer. Many prominent people from the community, including the mayor, two judges, and the members of the Meridian Police Department attended the funeral. Fred was only 5 years old at the time, and Catherine's sister Irene Jordan stepped in to help raise Fred and Martha, especially since their father's work would oftentimes take him away from home. People who knew the Phelpses back in the day noted that Fred had a very normal upbringing. Then, in December of 1944, Fred's dad married 39-year-old Olive Briggs, who happened to be a divorcee at the time. I mentioned the divorcee part for two reasons. Firstly, back in those days, divorce was more of a social taboo, and it was also quite rare and very hard to get divorced back then. Secondly, because this would later become a point of contention between Fred and his father. Fred attended Marion Park Elementary School in Meridian. Two journalists from the Capital Journal interviewed some of Fred's old classmates in an interview called The Transformation of Fred Phelps, which was published on 3 August 1994. Some of the descriptions given about Fred during his time in high school was that he was very intelligent, a little overbearing, he knew many people but didn't really socialize, he didn't date, and he was very good at anything that he tried. Fred graduated on 28 May 1946 at the age of 16. He ranked 6th in a class of 213. Among his accomplishments were becoming an Eagle Scout, being a Golden Gloves boxer, receiving an American Legion Citizenship Award, and being the best drilled member of the Mississippi Junior State Guard. And he was president of the Young People's Department of Central United Methodist Churches. Fred had been working towards a career in the military and was going to start this off by attending the United States Military Academy at West Point in New York. World War II had ended just 8 months before Fred graduated, and at that time, having a career in the military was seen as a very well-respected path to take. Actually, it is still a very noble career. Now, from what I have read about Fred, it seems like this dream of a career in the military was highly influenced by his father, and it's almost like he was pursuing this path to please his dad. But I don't think his heart was really in it. Fred had achieved his goal by receiving an appointment to West Point, but as the intake age of the academy was 17, and Fred was still 16, he would have to wait until that next year before he could attend. It was reported that Fred's father had pulled quite a lot of strings to get him in. However, in the summer of 1946, Fred's life would change. Fred and a school friend of his called John Capron spent a lot of time together over that summer. One of these times, they attended a sermon by a Methodist minister at the East End Methodist Church in their hometown. This sermon changed Fred's life. Fred recalled that it was the parable where the Lord Jesus said, "A certain man made a great supper and bade many to come, and they all began to make excuses. He said, 'The kingdom of heaven is like unto man who made the great supper.' His application of it was there was no logical, rational reason why any human being should not get right with God in his heart. He remembered that sermon pretty doggone good." After attending this sermon, both Fred and John became quite zealous in their faith. Fred would start preaching heavily to his family. One relative noted in an article, "Fred, bless his heart, just went overboard. If you didn't accept it, he was going to cram it down your throat." Fred's friend John would eventually marry Fred's sister Martha. To his father's dismay, Fred decided that he no longer wanted to pursue a career in the military and instead enrolled into Bob Jones College in January of 1947. This university was located in Cleveland, Tennessee, and was a non-denominational Christian university. Just as an interesting aside, the Internal Revenue Service revoked the college's tax-exempt status in 1983 for their racial discrimination. They have since opened the Bob Jones University in Greenville in South Carolina. By that summer, in 1947, Fred had converted from Methodist to Baptist. Now, I am not sure about all of the various Christian denominations. I was raised in the Dutch Reformed Church, which is very much fire and brimstone and all of that. So I found a few differences on ChristianFaithGuide.com. Firstly, Methodists baptize people of any age, where Baptists only permit baptism for youth and adults, as they require confession and repentance as a prerequisite, and infants and small children are not capable of this. On this subject, Methodists baptize with either sprinkling, pouring, or immersion, whereas Baptists only baptize by total immersion. Methodists practice open communion, where in the Baptist Church you have to be a baptized member to receive communion. Methodists seem to be more liberal compared to Baptists, and their faith is based upon personal experience and traditions, where Baptists are strict fundamentalists because the Bible is the only guide for all matters of faith. Once we get into Fred's later teachings, I think you'll see why he chose the Baptist route, as many of the points I mentioned before form part of his doctrine, which in some ways he's stricter in, but we'll get into his teachings a bit later in the series. That summer, Fred traveled to Vernal in Utah, where he worked as a missionary to convert the people in that town to their brand of Christianity. One day, Fred and a pastor from the First Baptist Church waded into a cold mountain stream in Utah, where he was baptized. Then, on 8 September 1947, at the age of 17, Fred was ordained as a Baptist minister. Even for that time, it was young for a man to be ordained at the age of 17, as most were around 20 when they were ordained. As Fred became more zealous about his faith, his relationship with his dad fractured even more. His dad was not impressed that Fred had opted to not pursue a career in the military, and Fred was not happy that his dad had remarried a divorcee. Here, we get a first glimpse of how strictly he would live according to his version of the Bible. You see, in Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 to 32, it basically says that if you divorce your wife, you make her an adulteress, and if you marry a divorced woman, you are committing adultery. After this, Fred never spoke to his family again, going as far as returning birthday cards, Christmas cards, and any letters that they sent to him. I do think he kept in touch with his Aunt Irene, though, because he later speaks very fondly of her. Sadly, Irene died in a car accident in 1950 while on her way from Hattiesburg to Meridian. In 1948, Fred dropped out of Bob Jones College. He then attended the Prairie Bible Institute in Three Hills, which is in Alberta, Canada. He lasted about 2 semesters, then left there to move to California in April of 1949. Here, he attended John Muir College in Pasadena, where he graduated with an associate's degree in engineering in 1951. He was also a street preacher during this time. I think this is where he realized that he could voice his opinions to anyone and everyone, and this was a precursor of things to come. He even featured in the 11 June 1951 edition of Time magazine, in an article titled Religion, Repentance in Pasadena, where they wrote about his preaching to his fellow students, how he was stopped from doing it, and even got suspended for it. Some students were not happy with his message, but others noted that he had a right to say what he believed in. The article said in part, Fred Phelps's talks drew crowds of up to 100. Over and over he denounced the sins committed on campus by the students and teachers. Promiscuous petting, evil language, profanity, cheating, teachers' filthy jokes in classrooms, pandering to the lusts of the flesh. The article later goes on to say, but evangelist Fred Phelps, who had turned down an appointment to West Point to devote his life to preaching, was not to be discouraged by a little thing like suspension. Last week, he was back, preaching from the lawn of a friendly Pasadena citizen across from the quadrangle. His audiences were bigger and more sympathetic. In fact, Fred Phelps now had something of the attraction of a martyr. In her book Unfollow, Megan Phelps Roper recalls how years later Fred kept a framed copy of this Time magazine article on the wall in his office. This article made the then 21-year-old Fred a little famous in the fundamental Christian circles, and he was often invited to be a guest speaker at various churches. In October of 1951, Fred was invited to preach in the chapel of the Arizona Bible Institute in Phoenix. To most, Fred looked much older than his 21 years. Being 6'3" and very seriously preaching to all in the room. In the audience that evening was 26-year-old Margie Marie Sims. Everyone called her Marge. Marge was born in Carrollton, Missouri, and was a postgraduate music student who had been invited to the sermon by her professor, Arthur Woods, and his wife, Laura. What Marge didn't know was that the reason she was invited was that Laura Woods had an ulterior motive for having her there. She was trying to play matchmaker between Fred and Marge. After the sermon, Fred sought Marge out on the advice of Laura. The two hit it off and would spend time together when they could over the next few weeks. He even drove her to get her license. By that January, Fred proposed. Laura Woods had made Marge's wedding dress, and they were married on 15 May 1952 in Arizona and had their first child on 4 May 1953, a son, who they named Fred Jr. During the first 2 years of their marriage, Fred was often away from home as he made his living by being a traveling preacher. When Marge was pregnant with their second child in 1954, the couple decided that they wanted to move to a town called Topeka in Kansas. Fred and Marge attended the Eastside Baptist Church in Topeka, where Fred was hired as an associate pastor. When congregations get too large for a specific church building, that denomination will oftentimes open another church on the other side of town to cater for all of its members. This is called church planting. And this is exactly what happened with the Eastside Baptist Church in Topeka. They opened another branch, which they called the Westboro Baptist Church. Fred was offered the position as pastor, and of course he accepted. The church's first public service was held on 27 November 1955. Before we continue, I just quickly want to touch on two subjects. The first of these is Calvinism. According to Britannica.com, Calvinism emphasizes the doctrine of predestination, holding that God extends grace and grants salvation only to the chosen or elect. It stresses the literal truth of the Bible, and it views the church as a Christian community in which Christ is head and all members are equal under him. The next subject I quickly want to look at is Primitive Baptists. According to Britannica.com, they believe that since mission societies, Sunday school, and central church organizations were not mentioned in the New Testament, there should never be any. It later goes on to explain, the Primitive Baptists are strict Calvinists who believe that only those elected by God will be saved. They accept the verbal infallibility of the Bible and expect the second coming of Christ. Ministers require no special training because Primitive Baptists believe that God can call anyone to be a minister and the missionaries are self-supporting. Fred's preaching style was very vitriolic. This radical preaching style alienated other Baptist church leaders and eventually caused the majority of his new congregation to either return to the Eastside Church or to join other churches. Fred was left with a small congregation, which consisted mostly of his relatives and a few close friends, two families, the Davises and the Hockenbergers. Between 1953 and 1968, Fred and Marge had 13 children, 5 sons and 8 daughters. Fred had insisted in choosing all of their names. They were Fred Jr., Mark, Catherine, Margie, Shirley, Nathan, Jonathan, Rebecca, Elizabeth, Timothy, Dortha, Rachel, and Abigail. Marge managed to raise all of these children by keeping to the same 5 rules she grew up with. Keep their faces clean, their hands clean, their clothes clean, keep the house clean, and keep them fed. As the congregation was so small, and to be able to support his growing family, Fred worked as a door-to-door salesman, selling vacuum cleaners, prams, and insurance. In between all of this, Fred would attend Washburn University, where he earned a law degree in 1964, and then he started the Phelps Chartered Law Firm. Now, let's just take a step back here and look at what was happening in America during this time. According to History.com, the civil rights movement was a struggle for the social justice that took place mainly during the 1950s and 1960s for Black Americans to gain equal rights under the law in the United States. The Civil War officially abolished slavery, but it didn't end discrimination against Black people. They continued to endure the devastating effects of racism, especially in the South. By the mid-20th century, Black Americans mobilized and began an unprecedented fight for equality that spanned two decades. Another significant court case had concluded when Fred and Marge moved to Topeka. The U.S. Supreme Court had heard the case of Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka. In its verdict, the court had ruled that separate but equal schools from African American and whites were unconstitutional. Once Fred had opened his law firm, he started taking on civil rights cases, cases that not even African American lawyers wanted to take on in case they couldn't get paid. He would defend African American people against discrimination in schools and at universities. He even took on cases where there was discrimination against women. One of his first cases had been to represent a group of African American students from the University of Kansas who were arrested for staging a sit-in. During the 1980s, Fred had received awards from the Greater Kansas City Chapter of Blacks in Government and from the Bonner Spring branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, for his work on behalf of African American clients. When asked why he took this on, he would quote a Bible verse, Exodus 12, verse 49, which read, "One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you, because God hath made of one blood all the nations of men to dwell on all the face of the earth." The law firm would often get phone calls spewing hate towards them for standing up for the rights of people of color. People would even shoot at their cars and their buildings. The family stood firm for the rights of colored people, despite the hate. I think this would prepare them for what was to come. Fred insisted that all 13 of his children study and join the law firm as soon as they were able, whether that was the field they were interested in or not. 11 of Fred and Marge's children would go on to study law and become lawyers. He would go on to demand that his children's spouses go to law school as well, so that they could all carry on with the family business. Outwardly, Fred looks like a stellar guy, with a bit of zealous preaching. But if we look closely at his home life and what he would preach to his congregants, well, then you will see why this group falls within my purview of a cult. Firstly, according to those who have left, they state that Fred only took on the civil rights cases for the money and was very racist behind the scenes. I'm going to insert a trigger warning here, as I will be speaking about allegations of abuse against women and children. So if this is in any way triggering, please skip over the next little bit. If one would question any of the family who were still members of the church, they would state that yes, Fred was strict, but no more than any other father. If you talk to any of Fred's children who had left, well, they paint a very different picture of their life at home. Nate Phelps, Fred and Marge's sixth child, who had escaped their home when he was 18, told a reporter in a Telegraph UK article, "He had this old barber's strap and used it so much that the last 6 inches were frayed, kind of like a cat o' nine tails, and he'd hit you with it, and it would wrap around your hips and rip the skin. By the time I turned 8, I remember he had started using a mattock handle instead. Similar to a pickaxe handle, it was about 4 feet long and bigger than a baseball bat. Nate goes on to describe how Fred would bend them backwards over the church pews until it felt like their backs were going to break. He describes how Fred would hit the children in turn and, in between, while he was busy with the one child, Marge would wipe the face of the other with a wet cloth. Other punishments included being beaten with fists, kicked in the stomach, or having their arms twisted up behind their backs. At times, he would make the children beat each other, and there was no chance of saying you didn't want to. Megan explains in her book Unfollow how she found out that Fred had not only beaten Marge as well, but had thrown her down the stairs where she tore the ligaments and cartilage in her right shoulder, and he had even once cut her hair down to the scalp because in his eyes she wasn't sufficiently in subjection to him. He would also beat her whenever she interjected while he was hitting one of the children. As soon as the children were able, Fred made them go out and sell boxes of sweets to people to supplement their income. They would be out from 3:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. peddling their wares. At one point, Fred learnt about the benefits of exercise and made the entire family, including the smaller children, run 10 miles every day. That's 16 kilometers a day. Great for the adults, but not so great for the small kids. And when Fred decided that they were to enter a marathon, they all needed to run their usual 10 miles per day, but 26 miles on a Saturday. They eventually entered and ran the 1970 Heart of America Marathon, and Timothy, who was barely 7 years old at the time, was the youngest entrant and took 7 hours to complete the race. Look, if fitness is your thing, more power to you. But making a 7-year-old run a marathon? I reached out to a friend of mine who has a young son around that age, and she said that it even seemed excessive. So I don't feel too bad in thinking that it was wrong. Behind Fred's back, the children used to refer to him as TB, which was short for the beast. Fred would keep fit for most of his life and participate in a triathlon. He added cycling to his daily exercise regime. All of the children were also made to take piano lessons. I noticed in a BBC documentary called America's Most Hated Family that even the grandchildren played some form of instrument. So I think this was carried forward into the next generation. Before I go into the history of the church, let's look at some of the doctrine that Fred taught his followers over the years. Firstly, they were only to use the 1611 King James Authorized Version of the Bible. Fred proclaimed that all other versions of the Bible were, quote, tainted by human hands and desires. I have always found it strange that people claim things like this when it was written by these human hands in the first place. Unlike groups we usually look into, the congregation of the church were allowed to read any books, watch any television shows or movies, and could listen to any music that they liked. Fred apparently said something along the lines of, that you can't defend against an evil if you don't know what the evil is that you're talking about. All of the congregants referred to Fred as Gramps. Now, knowing the fact that he had 54 grandchildren, I reckon it came more from a place of affection than a rule in the church. Fred also taught that other churches and Christian denominations were more like idolaters with no interest in knowing or doing what God required of them. One of the primary doctrines was that God hated sinners as well as the sin. So God's elect, i.e., the Westboro Baptist Church congregation must also hate sinners, or as they refer to them, reprimands, even those who might be assembled with them. Here we can see the us versus them teachings come to the fore. Fred refused to baptize babies, which makes sense because it's in Baptist church. He likened the baptism of the children to burning the child alive in sacrifice to a pagan god. He claimed that baptism wasn't a rite of passage, but was only given when a believer was called to ask for it. In the same breath, if you were part of the church as an adult and had not chosen to get baptized yet, you were definitely looked down upon by the other members. Baptisms were performed in the church in the baptismal, a big blue tub. In the summer months, it was performed in the swimming pool in the communal backyard. Another thing that struck me is that most of the families live on the same street. I don't know if there was a specific rule made about this, but those who lived in close proximity broke down the walls in their backyards, which separated them, and made one big communal garden where all of the children could play together. In this backyard, there's a swimming pool, a ball court, and a trampoline. Then there's the usual. Everyone needs to attend Sunday services and are to tithe 10% of their earnings to the church. In the past, Fred used to hold an 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. service on Sunday, but would later only have one at 11:30 a.m. Fred held Bible study each morning at 7:30. All of the church members who work are required to still give of their free time to help out with the church. This will become important later on in the series. Fred firmly believed and preached that they were living in the last days, like the end of the world was near and that Jesus would definitely be coming in his lifetime, which led into his doctrine of telling his followers that they were the only people left on earth who were going to be saved. Behind Fred's pulpit is a sign that reads Tachmonite. I looked at a few sites as to what it means, and on one of the sites it says it means wise. And it refers to a passage in the Bible where David's wise captain was sitting in a seat. With all of this, I can only assume that it is right above Fred's head at his pulpit and that he sees himself as the true wise truth-sayer. On a poster off to the side of the pulpit is a sign with the acronym TULIP, or TULIP. This is in reference to the 5 points of Calvinism. T is for total depravity, which basically means that all people are enslaved to sin, and that they are morally unable to choose to trust God for their salvation. U is for unconditional election. This, in a nutshell, means that God has already chosen who will be saved, by His grace only, and not on their merit. This will also play into later doctrine, which Fred loved to use. L is for limited atonement, which means that God could have chosen to save all mankind, but instead he sent his son Jesus to die for the sins of only his elect. I is for irresistible grace, which means that when God decides to save a person, that person will not only be saved, but will have no power to resist God's call to salvation. And finally, P is for perseverance of the saints, which means that God's elect will persevere until the end of days and will be saved. This led into using the story of the brothers Jacob and Esau to keep his flock in line. The followers would be taught that God had chosen to love Jacob and hate and condemn Esau when they were in their mother's womb. That Jacob was predestined to be good and go to heaven, while Esau was the complete opposite. Whenever any of the children would step out of line, they would be asked if they wanted to be like Jacob or Esau. And to top it off, even if you do follow all of the rules that Fred sets out, You are still not guaranteed to be a Jacob. You'll only know when you get to the final judgment. If you end up in hell, you will end up being adjudicated in exhaustive detail over every wrong thought, word, or deed that you had ever committed. This would be presided over by the people in heaven. In her book, Unfollow, Megan Phelps Roper says, each one of the saints of God would have a caseload, as it were, personally condemning the reprobates to an eternity of agony and rejoicing at their endless suffering. It seems to me like Fred was using some of his legal background to explain how things would work in hell. In the next episode, we will continue with some of the doctrine taught by Fred and also continue with the history of the church. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit the subscribe button and rate and review us. It will go a long way into improving the podcast and helping others find it. Please invite your family and friends to listen as well. If you're listening on YouTube, please subscribe and like the video. You can also leave comments if you want. You can find us on Facebook and you can email us at decodingcults@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. I've added my PayPal link should you wish to support the show financially. It'll go towards purchasing better equipment. If there are any topics around the workings of cults which you would like further explanation on, or if there is a cult that you would like to hear about, email me or post it in the Facebook group. Remember to go and check out By Design Crafts SA and Endeavor AV and tell them that I sent you. The amazing logo art was created by the tattoo artist Jock Jacobs. Thank you so much for listening.